Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, High Up MAGA Guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there. Welcome to Spy Talk. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
Well, this week we decided to do our pet peeves to lead off the session. We got a great interview coming up with Jim Hines, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, and he's got lots to say about lots of things going on in the always busy intelligence community under the Trump regime. My pet peeve of the week is a new report saying the United States is conducting a kind of a preparation for a coup d'etat, it sounds like, in Greenland. According to news reports, Danish news reports picked up by the AP, the Danish foreign minister has called on the carpet the top U.S. diplomat in Copenhagen and said, "What the hell's going on in Greenland? We have reports from eight sources saying that three Americans who are not identified were trying to manipulate politics in Greenland, find out." To kind of exaggerate or stir up anti-Copenhagen sentiment among the Greenlanders. And that's kind of easy because the majority, according to all reports, the majority of Greenlanders are pretty unhappy with the way Denmark's been treating them over the decades or maybe centuries. And so it's fertile ground for foul play by CIA against one of our stalwart NATO allies. So that's my pet peeve. The CIA should not be trying to overthrow the Greenland government.
Now, to be fair, Jeff, we don't know that this was the CIA.
That's right.
It's just been reported three people close to Trump. So it'll be very interesting to see whether the Danish reveal the identities.
Yeah, it could be some amateurs.
But you would hope they would at least consult with the CIA, since the CIA used to have a track record of stirring up dissent in overseas countries. It usually was in American adversaries, not fellow NATO members. But I want to, my little pet peeve, I want to come back to the Tulsi Gabbard's actions last week, revoking the security clearances of 37 current and former intelligence professionals who, she said, in her words, have abused the public trust by politicizing and manipulating intelligence, leaking classified information without authorization, and or committing intentional egregious violations of tradecraft standards. Now,
that's some super irony there.
Yeah, right. Gabbard, who has completely manipulated intelligence documents to please the president. But what struck me, first of all, as we all reported last week when we discussed this, no instances were given of what the 37 people are alleged to have done wrong or fit into this category. And I was struck by one of them, a former CIA officer named Yael Eisenstadt, who has gone on to the private sector, NGO sector. She was with Facebook, Meta for a while. She has been open and outspoken about the threats to democracy. But, you know, all the stuff that was reported about those firings were about most of it were people who were somehow involved in the Russia investigation, either the original, counterintelligence investigation by the FBI, or later the Russia intelligence assessment. Yael Eisenstadt hasn't been in government since 2013. She had no role in the Russia investigation. She had no role in the assessment of the
ICC. Gotta hunt down these enemies anywhere.
So what had she done wrong? She had been public about her criticism of President Trump. She wrote in her on X, "I have spoken openly and transparently since 2015 about the dangers of a president politicizing the death of CIA officers. Without any explanation of why I have been targeted, I am left to assume it is because I have chosen to exercise my free speech rights." So grounds for revocation of security clearance by the government now is you criticize the government. That is big apparently brain. The new Tulsi Gabbard standard.
Okay, Karen, what's your pet peeve?
Well, my pet peeve sort of follows from that pretty well, which is the firing of the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency this week and Jeffrey Cruz. And, you know, when you really think about what's happening, you know, Michael is just talking about revenge, right? Getting back at old investigations. But what about new investigations? Because under the DIA, a report was issued which said that the attacks on Iran earlier this year did not have the devastating consequences on the nuclear bomb development that we're so worried about. And the question is, you know, where's the truth? How do we find out what the truth is? Indeed. Is the report that was put together by professionals within the Trump administration something we're supposed to say, oh, that makes sense? Or we're supposed to just say, if it doesn't follow the line that the president and his cabinet wants, then the person goes away, and therefore does the report go away as well? And I think the consequences of this are not just about ego, and they're not just about professionalism. They're about more than that, which is that how are we going to know and be able to trust that what the United States is doing in the world is something that is legal, that is, dare I say, moral, that is transparent in some way or other. And I don't mean transparent of classified information. I mean transparent in terms of who worked on it. What did they say? What do we know? And we're kind of left in a place as a populace, which is we don't know. And that is a really, I think, in many ways, unprecedented stage, and I think very dangerous stage for when we think about the future of democracy.
Well, I guess this is why God invented the press.
I was going to say that, but then I decided I'd leave it for you guys.
A little self-serving on our part to dimension.
It's the fourth estate. We play the role here because we're looking at a black box.
Yes, we are. Hey, listen, I got one last item I just want to throw out there just because it's
just so, because you
just because
Mike Israel.
Right, exactly. Look, we've all spent a lot of time over the last few years talking about conspiracy theory. So I just sort of throw that out there, you know, the whirl of conspiracy theories and all that. So last week, we were also all focused on a former Trump national security advisor, John Bolton, who was having his house and office searched by the FBI, apparently because of some investigation that he mishandled. Classified information. We don't have any details yet. We don't know whether there's a real case against John Bolton or this is just another instance of retribution. But I was struck by something I came across about another former national security advisor of Donald Trump. In fact, it was his first national security advisor during his first term as president. I think we have a clip that perhaps our listeners and my co-hosts might want to listen to.
Hey, everyone, I'm General Mike Flynn, and I want to personally invite you to join us for the John Birch Society Leadership Conference, September 13, 2025, in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. I've recently confirmed very treasonous activity that all Americans should be aware of. And this communist coup that is going on and has been going on for a long time now is very real. Find out more at this leadership conference by the John Birch Society. Buy your tickets at jbs.org today. That's jbs.org today. See you on September 13th. God bless you and God bless America.
Karen, I witnessed your jaw dropping as we played the clip from
Mike Flynn. You know, it's everybody says the quiet part, not just out loud now, but amplified and projected and is proud of it. And it just sort of shocked me. I mean, I know I'm not coming up with the sufficient words for it, but it was really quite.
I mean, the John Birch Society, let's remember, sort of, you know, was the purveyor of the most bizarre conspiracy theories during the 50s and 60s, starting with the idea in its founder, Robert Welch's Blue Book, that Dwight Eisenhower was a conscious agent of the communist conspiracy. Now, there you have Flynn. Here we are, what, 60, more than 60 years later, 70 years later, talking about the communists out there.
Flynn embraced QAnon and all that nuttiness. Yeah, so
yeah, but it's good to see that the old style conspiracy theories and organizations are still out there. I just leave that for our listeners to contemplate.
Certainly gives us something to talk about.
Yep.
We want you to stay tuned for this fascinating interview with Jim Hines, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. He's going to put some cement around these ideas that we've been talking about because he's a player. You know, he's in the middle of the intelligence action that's been going on. At least he's trying to find out as much as he can about what the Trump administration is up to. So stay tuned for that. Here he is. Congressman Jim Hines, welcome to Spy Talk, or I should say, welcome back to Spy Talk. And it's always a great honor for us to have you on our show. So thank you very much for spending time with us on a very busy, per usual, week for you. My first question is the House Intelligence Committee actually doing oversight? And what kind of oversight is it? With all this busy work going on at the DNI and so on, mass layoffs, security cancellations, are you folks actually monitoring that, looking into that?
The answer to that question is yes. And thanks for having me. Really appreciate these discussions always, and especially the question you just asked, because, you know, you don't need to read a lot of headlines to know that there's been some pretty dramatic firings. Some pretty dramatic restructurings inside the intelligence community. And that is, of course, exactly what oversight is required. And, you know, I'm sorry to report that half the committee is doing oversight. I probably fire a letter a week off to Tulsi Gabbard in particular, asking questions about her latest depredations. I don't get a lot of support, frankly, on that from the majority. Which pains me. It pains me for two reasons. Number one, you know, the new chairman, Rick Crawford, is a friend of many years, but he's very different than Mike Turner, the previous chairman. Mike was independent. And by the way, I think that's maybe why Mike Turner is not chairman anymore. And I think Rick read the tea leaves there. And I will tell you, the good news is that considering how broken the committee was many years ago under the sort of Schiff-Nunes arrangement, you know, Rick and I have a pretty good detente, but he's not really interested in asking the questions that if this were the Biden administration doing these things, he would be lighting buildings on fire over. So, you know, good news is we're doing all we can to keep the committee together and from devolving into a partisan slugfest, but only half the committee is doing anything meaningful related to oversight.
Now, I know Mike and Karen have some pressing questions for you. Just before we leave this topic, what does that mean when there's not really? Do you as the leader of the Democrats on the committee request a meeting behind closed doors to discuss these firings, and then you get rebuffed? Is that what that means?
Yeah. And, you know, though it's an unhappy place to be in the minority, you know, I've got some leverage. I don't have subpoena power. That's reserved to the majority. But, you know, if we go back to the reauthorization of FISA 702, we can get into that if you like. That has to happen in April of this year. Candidly, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn here, but that got passed in the last Congress, largely due to some very hard work that I and my colleagues did on the Democratic side. I suspect they're going to want our help on that. Of course, we're working on the Intelligence Authorization Act, and that's always been, or I shouldn't say always, it's generally been, once the committee was repaired, a bipartisan process. So yeah, there is some leverage. But what it looks like is me saying to Tulsi Gabbard, you fired the head of the NSA. Rumors are that that was done because Laura Loomer picked up the phone and called the Oval. Is that true? And I get fadabba-dabba-dabba, you know, personnel issues, fadabba-dabba-dabba, you know, and I just keep pushing and, you know, try to get. And of course, you know, now we've had whatever the number was to 47 people with their security clearances removed and the firing of the DIA director. So I will be writing a letter. I am writing a letter to Tulsi saying apparently the United States has a very substantial problem in identifying, according to you and the Secretary of Defense, good IC leadership. You've now fired two of them. And apparently we award security clearances in a way that is unsatisfactory to you. So send me the files. I'd really like to know why security clearances were revoked and why these very senior leaders were fired. And I'll, you know, I'll keep that up.
Congressman, let me just follow up on that, because based on some information I got from somebody in the IC, I was pointed to something on the ODNI website called the DIG, Directors Initiative Group. And it turns out this is something that was set up by Gabbard back in April. I'm told it's sort of an offshoot of Musk's Doge group. And this DIG has been the group that has been culling through all these documents and making the decisions about what gets released and whose security clearance gets revoked. What do you know about the DIG? Who are they? Who's the head of it? Where did they come from? How do they operate? Are you aware of this group, and have you received any information about who they are and what they're doing?
There was a fair amount of fanfare when Director Gabbard announced this group, you know, and it had all of the usual MAGA trimmings. This is a group of advisors who will, you know, get at the deep state and stop the politicization of the intelligence community. Never mind the fact that, of course, every single day there's another egregious politicization or weaponization of the actions of the Director of National Intelligence. You know, it's just sort of classic in that regard, you know, talk about accusing other people of doing what you do every day. But the point is, we don't have a ton of visibility. But what I have heard from people at the office of the or at the ODNI is that the director is sort of not interested in doing the day to day work of really going out there to the, Malign Influence Center or to the National Counterterrorism Center to really understand.
That's been eliminated.
It's gone.
Right.
It's gone.
No, I know. You know, all of these various elements, you know, people in the elements tell me we haven't actually seen the director. And again, I try to be fact-based, which is why I describe my approach with respect to clearances and firings. Let's see the information. But it's very, you know, it's sort of hard to escape the fact that Tulsi Gabbard is using the ODNI and probably other elements of the intelligence community to advance her MAGA credibility with the president, who, of course, demands 100% loyalty. So surprise, surprise, when the DIA comes out with a report saying that the Iran attack may have not been the obliteration of their nuclear infrastructure, or when the National Intelligence Council, just to name another one, comes out with a report saying that Tren de Aragua is not actually driven, directed by the Venezuelan government, inconsistent with what the president says, all of those people are fired. What a coincidence. What a coincidence.
So on the DIG, do you know who the head of it is? Do you know how many members there are? Do you know anything about how they are operating?
Are they intelligence professionals to any degree?
Do they all have top secret security clearances?
Yeah, you're sort of catching me in an August moment, because when the DIG was announced, you know, there were a number of people, members announced inside, you know, and these were people who were not, you know, eminence grise, if you will. You know, these were people who were friends of Tulsi's. And, you know, since then, we have not seen a lot of direct activity by the DIG, but it's there, and it appears to be where the director is spending her time.
Yeah, I mean, all the releases are accompanied on the ODNI website as coming from the Director's Initiative Group, DIG. So
look,
they're
again,
the ones making the calls.
I really do work hard to be fact-based and evidence-based on this stuff, but lo and behold, rather than interact with intelligence professionals, it turns out the Director of National Intelligence would like to have a kitchen cabinet of people, presumably of like-minded ambitions and politics, where she can, you know, get her information and do her thing. So, you know, yeah, this is all part and parcel of the substantial politicization, not to say weaponization, of the intelligence community.
I have so many questions. My first one, which is just in a sense, you know, you're saying you're writing all these letters to Tulsi Gabbard, right? How many of them get responded to?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you a story. I told you about the leverage that I have with respect to working hard to get FISA 702. We can spend more time on that if you like. But, you know, I finally told her people I've got six unanswered letters over a period of 3 months. And guys, you know, I'm going to be about as responsive to you on your objective with respect to 702 as you have been to me. Lo and behold, the next week I got, you know, three or four letters answered. And so were they satisfactorily answered? No, they weren't. This is a classic sort of oversight game. I got sort of partial information. But nonetheless, when I raise a little hell, I do tend to get information back. But, you know, it's my job to keep pounding on this oversight.
Can we talk about 702 for just a minute? I mean, this is
Let's just explain what that is. That's the electronic eavesdropping program.
Well, yeah, let's set the baseline here. So, you know, FISA 702 was set up because when we are simply spying on foreigners, there's not a constitutional issue about that abroad. You know, so people know, you know, we pick up cell phone calls and all sorts of stuff. And when it's just foreigners, there's no legal issue. The problem is twofold. Number one, there's a whole category of intelligence collection where on the other side of that email or on the other side of that text is a U.S. citizen. And of course, a U.S. citizen, wherever that citizen is located, has constitutional rights. And any person inside the United States also is a U.S. person, has constitutional rights. So that creates a sort of legal challenge, as does the fact that, lo and behold, email, text, you know, Facebook, other places where we might like to get information are often U.S. companies. And so, you know, you do have a situation where an intelligence component or the FBI wants to get information on a Pakistani. And so they have to go to a U.S. company, Gmail, let's just say. And that, of course, requires additional legal process. That's why FISA 702 exists. And two things to say about it without going too far down the 702 rabbit hole. Number one, it's an absolutely essential collection tool, right? You know, when we were reauthorizing last time, something like 60 plus percent of the president's daily brief came from FISA 702 collection. Mm-hmm. It is literally everywhere. Mm-hmm. Without it, we are probably half blind to our enemies. Number one. Number two, because it does involve capturing emails and texts that have U.S. person information and U.S. person content, there's a whole legal structure built around, you know, when I'm probably a bad example, but when an American is, you know, emailing a Pakistani who, for whatever reason, is the subject of collection, there's a whole set of protections around that U.S. person's emails. Who can go after it? Under what circumstances? What do you need to do to query whether that U.S. person is in the database? And it's a very elaborate set of protections for American citizens that has been subject to negotiations since FISA 702 was created. With, of course, you know, the more civil liberties minded people, in particular the ACLU and the, you know, and others, sort of demanding more process and protection. And for lack of a better word, if I may draw a little bit of a cartoon, people who sort of understand how critical this collection tool is, pushing for, you know, care in how those restrictions are put in place.
Karen, back to you. Sorry, I interrupted you before.
Yeah, no. So my question about 702 is, you know, everybody worked so hard to get a version of 702 that could actually pass. And, you know, particularly with the queries, who could be queried, it wasn't going to be abused. Are you worried about trying to get it through this time and how the agreement and the understanding of balance between civil liberties and security issues might be abused by those who are currently running the show? Or do you think this can go through in a way that can really sort of balance the equities that have been agreed on in the past?
That's a really good question, Karen. And of course, the politics really matter here, right? Let me just say, at the risk of sounding partisan, that I think your average person on the street has a higher degree of comfort with President Obama, constitutional law professor, President Biden, you know, abiding by the law, having access to this tool than they are with Donald Trump having access to this tool and his administration, because the hallmark of his administration has been three times a day to act in a clearly unconstitutional fashion, whether it's, you know, denying Congress's right to the power of the purse. I mean, I could go on and on and on. So the political problem is actually much more substantial, because people are like, well, I was a little uncomfortable with Joe Biden having this collection power. But yeah. Donald Trump, are you freaking yeah. kidding me? So there's going to be a lot of that. Mm. And, you know, what'll get lost there is that if you look at the numbers, you know, when the Republicans were in opposition, they made a big deal of the fact that, and it was true, by the way, that five, six, seven years ago, there was a lot of sloppiness in the handling of U.S. person data. And it wasn't, you know, FBI agents trying to get emails from their ex-wives. It wasn't that at all. It was just procedures that weren't good enough and training that wasn't good enough. And as a result, abusive queries of U.S. person information, it's gone down by like 96, 97, 98%. As a result of better training and better procedures. But Karen, to your point and what I just said, the politics are going to make it very, very hard for Democrats to support the reauthorization in the numbers that they did a mere year ago. Now, of course, the Republicans, Donald Trump will tell them to support that, and they will say, yes, sir, how can I help, sir? You know, so that'll be a new dynamic.
So can I just take you back to your little instance of hardball there, where you told the ODNI folks that you might not cooperate on 702 if they didn't start answering your letters. What did you mean by that? What were you actually threatening to do or not do when you made that threat? And it apparently worked. So do you plan to do more of it?
Well, the way you frame it, Michael, you really highlight something very painful for me, which is that the reauthorization of this tool is really, really critical. And it pains me to have to say to Tulsi Gabbard, hey, Tulsi, you know, you may look at me with disdain, but you're going to need me down the road and a couple of things. So, you know, focus on some things that I care about. And I don't like using 702 as a negotiating tool, but in the minority, it's kind of the one, you know, one of a couple of cards I have to play. And I told her the story. And look, this really irritates the ACLU.
So this was a personal conversation you had with her. You called her up.
Yeah. I think I was most pointed with her deputy or somebody. Okay. You know, they came in to talk about something. And I said, it's really hard to have this conversation when I've got six or seven letters with very simple questions outstanding now over a period of months. And then I said, and I think I've said this to Tulsi as well. Look, again, disdain me. Apparently, I'm a Bolshevik communist, deep state tool, blah, 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 blah. But you know what? You are going to need my help on some things. You know, that, again, produced some results. But look, in the case of 702, I described the story. There was an attempt to include a full warrant requirement. And this gets a little technical, legally speaking, but there was an attempt to include a full warrant requirement, meaning anytime we wanted to know who this Pakistani terrorist was talking to in Los Angeles, you know, an agent would have to go before a court and get the same kind of warrant that they would get if they wanted to knock down your door or search John Bolton's house, which is a lengthy process. And that amendment would have passed had I not changed a couple of votes on the floor, literally in the 2 minutes we were voting on the amendment. So fine, Tulsi, you know, call me everything you want. But you know what? You may need my help down the road on some things. And that, again, produced some results.
OK, we're going to step away for a minute. We'll be back and we're going to ask Congressman Hines about something rotten going on in Denmark. Okay, we're back. Okay, I have a question on a couple other subjects. And I should note that in terms of changes at the ODNI leadership, Amaryllis Fox Kennedy has been brought aboard to, quote, modernize U.S. intelligence. What do you can you add anything to our understanding of that? She's a former CIA operations officer who married the son of RFK Jr.
Yeah. Look, and I've been fairly direct about some of the problems that I fear Tulsi Gabbard is generating in ODNI. So let me be fair here and say that there is no question that there are lots of streamlining reforms, thoughtful questions around how the IC is structured that should be asked. And so I'm not dismissing the proposed reorganization of ODNI out of hand.
Yeah, the general consensus has been, that's been a bloated agency. It's expanded way beyond what its original remit is. In fact, Tom Cotton has a bill in the hole to return it to its original size of 650 staffers. And that a lot of people would say that's overdue. That slimming should have been done a long time ago. That's not a partisan issue.
Yeah. And that's the only argument I would make there would be, let's do the work to figure out what ODNI is doing well and what it's not and what it's doing that it shouldn't be doing. And then let's figure out what the right resources are. Let's not start with some arbitrary number and say, let's work to that number. So, and it's a totally fair effort. I mean, look, there are members of Congress, I disagree with this, but there are members of Congress who would like to see the ODNI go away. Even though it's sort of statutorily required. So it's a totally fair conversation. But if you're me and you watched DOGE move through the federal government for 6 months and you watched the very political activities of Tulsi Gabbard, while I'm open-minded, I am careful and skeptical. And by the way, I mean, you guys know this very well. There's all sorts of questions we should be asking about the structure of the IC that might implicate the ODNI. Let me give you a good one because it's something I've been thinking hard about. You know, open source. You all know this. We can learn almost anything on open source. And we have it inside the CIA right now. They're the national manager for OSINT. You all know that the CIA's culture is one of skulking around in alleys in Kandahar or sidling up to Chinese colonels in Kuala Lumpur. That's what they do. And so you could legitimately ask the question, is the CIA, and given their culture, is that the right place for the federal government's open source? That's a great question. So there are all sorts of really good questions, some of which you have asked that deserve consideration. So I'm not shutting down or saying that, you know, the ideas to reshape ODNI are necessarily bad, but color me a little bit skeptical.
Do you have, speaking of these various programs and overseas, what the CIA does, there's a report out of the AP today that I saw today, saying that the Danish foreign minister had called in the U.S. charge d'affaires in Denmark to say, what the hell is going on in Greenland? They are accusing the United States of using clandestine means, covert action to overthrow the Greenland government, essentially. Inappropriate activity. So, the U.S. agents are trying to aggrandize anti-Copenhagen feelings among the Greenlanders and organize some sort of coup that would enable a U.S. invasion or takeover, a coup d'etat in Greenland. Did you know anything about this, Jesse? If this is legitimate, it's pinned on people close to Trump. We don't know if these are CIA people or not at this time. But if they were, my question is, was a covert action run by you at the committee to manipulate Greenland politics? Did you know about that? And or what can you tell us about it?
Yeah. Jeff, when we're talking about covert action, I have to be at my most careful, and I don't like to, deny or confirm. I will tell you this. If there is an IC-driven effort to subvert the Danes or to do anything in Greenland, it would be absolutely shocking to me. And the fact that it would be shocking to me probably means that it would have been an illegal effort were it, in fact, an effort by the intelligence community. I'll leave that there. So I will just
illegal
tell you now,
illegal meaning that it was not run by the appropriate committees on the Hill.
So all covert action programs are by law reportable to the Congress, and in particular, the Intelligence Committee. So when I tell you that such a covert effort would be a radical departure from anything I've heard, you can sort of fill in the blanks there. again, I don't want to get into what I know or don't know about covert action programs, but mind you, I've been out of D.C. for 5 weeks. It's August, right? So, you know, who the hell knows what got cooked up in the interim.
A good time to be out of D.C., by the way.
While the cats are away, the mice will play.
Can I, on the issue of what you are briefed on and what you're told, you're a member of the Gang of Eight, which is the leaders of the intelligence committees in both the House and the Senate, and the two leaders of the House and the Senate. I have seen it reported that the Gang of Eight was not briefed on the Iran missile strikes before they took place. So it raises the question in my mind, how often is the Gang of Eight getting briefed these days? What have you been briefed on? What have you not been briefed on? And how does that differ from the way things had been in the past?
Yeah. So with respect to the strikes on Iran, what I can tell you is that I think there was a desultory and unconvincing effort made to reach out to the Gang of Eight and various members. I personally was not reached out to. Now, it occurred on a weekend when we weren't in D.C., but nonetheless, one of the egregious aspects of that military attack was that not even in any meaningful way was the Gang of Eight briefed, which is egregious. We could have the whole conversation about whether we should abide by the Constitution, which says that the Congress should declare war, but let's set that aside for the moment. Michael, the answer to your question is that we are playing a huge game of defense right now with respect to our notifications and oversight responsibilities. You know this because you probably heard the press reports that all of a sudden, lo and behold, the administration was thinking of significantly dialing back the reporting that they did on the status of the Iran nuclear program subsequent to the strikes. Well, and again, I can't get into the details, but that is not an acceptable proposition to the Congress. It's illegal. Again, there's this fundamental law that anything that is material and adverse or material in any event, certainly congressional, findings, presidential findings, which are the basis for covert action programs. All of this stuff by law must be reported to the Congress. And as you might imagine, we're playing a hell of a game of defense saying you've got to continue to abide by these laws, which, you know, they're about as comprehensive and committed to as they are in the domestic laws and domestic reporting that you read about in the paper every day.
Right. Did the Iran attack, did that provoke you to write to the White House and tell them, you know, they've got to start reporting? Was there action taken because you were not notified?
Yeah. And, you know, you can continue the generations long argument over war powers. This goes, as you know, literally goes back generations. And the president will assert the authority, just as Obama asserted when he finally said that I don't really need congressional authority to strike Syria, as he asserted back in, I don't know, 2009, 2010. You know, that goes on and on and on. And I've always been, as you might imagine, trying to protect the prerogatives of Congress, very much of the belief that, you know, at a minimum, there must be advance notification and there should be debate, et cetera. But anyway, predictably, the, President Trump, said that it was his authority as commander in chief to take the strikes that he did. What is not okay and what would be completely unacceptable and illegal would be an effort to squelch subsequent collection of the intelligence about what the battle damage assessments, et cetera, were. And of course, the administration was so embarrassed by the very initial reporting that was reported in the press that led to the firing, of the chief of the Defense Intelligence Agency that, we have to be extremely suspicious that they are squelching reporting that is important and legally required to the Congress.
You know, you keep talking, Congressman, about laws, constitutional laws, statutory, but I'm curious more about, or just as much, about norms and procedural norms in particular. And my question is about the post-9/11 intelligence and security state and the way it was set up. It looks to me, even in this most recent, firing of a DIA head, that the dismantling, that's what's happening, that the 9/11 state that was created is being dismantled one by one through the firings, through the reappointments of people, through the ending of the foreign malign influence, through the ending of the particular role or pivoting of the role of the Department of the Division of National Security at the Department of Justice. Do you see it that way or not? And because remember, after 9/11, the question was, what went wrong? And one of the things that went wrong was sharing information, trusting the information, knowing how to protect the secrecy of information, briefing Congress. What, you know, what do you see in terms of where we've been and where we're going?
Yeah, it's a good question, Karen. And I think I think about it slightly differently. I don't think that there has been an explicit effort to dismantle the 9/11 state, if you will. I think that what we're seeing instead is attacking those things that the president doesn't like. So the president doesn't like the fact that it was very clear to everybody, including, by the way, Marco Rubio, when he oversaw the report and the Senate Intelligence Committee, that the Russians meddled in the 2016 election. They did. It's not subject to debate, but it drives the president crazy. And so as a consequence, we see the intelligence community, I think largely at the direction of the Director of National Intelligence, trying to cut the ground out from all of the elements that arrived at that conclusion. So people who participated in that investigation and the writing of the ICA, lo and behold, have had their clearances revoked, in some cases have been fired. The unit, the Malign Influence Center, both inside the DNI and at the State Department, have been dismantled. This is very clearly an effort to appease a president who can't stand the idea, even though it's factual, that the 2016 election, the Russians played on his behalf. What I would tell you, and this is important to add, Karen, you know, one of the primary lessons of the 9/11 report and the 9/11 experience was that we had a highly stovepiped intelligence community. Not only did the FBI not communicate with the CIA, there was a cultural disdain between them and competition. When you say dismantlement of the 9/11 state, I'm happy to report that that problem was, I'm not going to use the word fixed because there's always bureaucratic turf wars, et cetera, but that problem was really well dealt with. And
yeah,
it's not
right.
It's not getting worse now. It's just, this is all an effort. And if you think about it, it's all an effort to appease this president who is just a huge black hole of personal ego. And so Kash Patel and Tulsi Gabbard and, you know, John Ratcliffe, to his credit, sort of, you know, he kind of disappears into the background. But so many of the president's men and women just wake up in the morning and say, how can I make the president feel good this morning?
Did you watch that cabinet meeting yesterday where all they did was heap praise on dear leader?
For more than three hours. Now, we have to wrap this up, Congressman.
Augusto Pinochet and Joseph Stalin, you know, are jealous, right?
Kim Jong-un. Again, we have to wrap this up. I was prompted to ask by your last response, have you been briefed on, have you detected Russian malign influence in the social media sphere or elsewhere to influence our politics going on now?
The answer to that question is yes. And it takes a different form than it took in 2016. Remember in 2016, and again, I have to restate the facts because they're facts, you know, the Russian intelligence services broke into the servers of the DNC to take out compromising and embarrassing information. They're not doing that. Now, that doesn't mean they're not going to do that in 2026. But right now, it's more classic propaganda, you know, trying to sidle up to, you know, news mouthpieces, you know, the classic propaganda play, trying to get, you know, countries, use your leverage with countries to get their votes at the UN. That sort of classic propaganda thing is very much an effort. And by the way, so is screwing around in the cyber world, right? I mean, we see constant attempts on the part of the Russians, and sometimes it's the Russian state and intelligence, you know, people. Sometimes it's these shadowy groups that are probably affiliated with the Russian state, just looking for vulnerabilities 24/7.
Yeah. Hacks are a big problem here. Anyway, thank you, Congressman Hines, for coming on the show again. It's just it's an honor for us to have you, and it's always valuable. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have to leave it there. This has been another exciting, we hope, edition of the Spy Talk podcast. But meanwhile, be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai out there in California and edited by Molly Hawkey just outside New York for MSW Media. And so that's it for now. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.